final part of the interview with Charles Noss took place in Bethesda, Maryland, on August 16th.
19th, 1988. Now, Richard Kahn, among others, have suggested that President Carter's rhetorical emphasis on human rights as a general principle of American policy tended to encourage Iranian activists, leading them to take political risks they might not have taken. How much of this was understood in the State Department and the embassy? This question of the impact of Carter's declaratory policy regarding human rights. How much was understood about the impact of this policy on Iranian politics?
It's hard to say at what level you're talking, John, in terms of it being understood. Certainly, I viewed it as from two viewpoints, really. As one, it created a great uncertainty on the Shah himself and among those who were his closest supporters. They wondered what we had in mind. So I think even though the president was extremely effusive in both meetings with His Imperial Majesty, and except for minor items really, sold to the Shah most of the equipment that he wanted, so as a declaratory policy without any major impact on the day-to-day events.
Yeah, that's right.
But it did worry the Shah. He continuously is worried what we might have in mind. And the other thing that was quite clear, it seems to me, is that the opposition was greatly encouraged by this. In Iran, people were always looking at the great cause. What did the Soviets say? The Americans said. And so this shift in a declaratory policy definitely encouraged them to become more open. They felt somewhat protected by the president. I will not mention the high official who confirmed this, but he told me this very frankly after the revolution, that the whole human rights policy had encouraged him to write, for example, and to start speaking more openly. I'd like to make one clarification. I mean, many Iranians like to blame President Carter and these policies sort of for the downfall of the Shah. Well, that's obviously going to the extreme on it. It is a contributory factor, and probably not a very great one. But I think it also, as I said to you in, I think, the previous meetings, when the opposition went onto the streets and it was starting to get violence, this is pure guesswork on my part. I'm sure that the Shah felt somewhat constrained in his policies of what he could do in reaction, because he was never quite sure if the President of the United States would stay with him. But in my view, the forces that were unleashed certainly do not lie with President Carter or the administration's policy. But it wasn't a certain contributory thing.
Okay. Now also, Kahn suggests, this is in his recent book, he suggests that the Shah's actions during the 77-78 period followed the same pattern as in the early 60s. The idea was to ride out the crisis by giving the opposition more room to maneuver, with the expectation that he could avoid making any real concessions to them in terms of giving up power. And even in these other similarities, he appointed Sheriff Amami as the Prime Minister in late 60, and then he brings him back in late September, August 78. Did anybody at the State Department or the embassy take a look back in the early 60s to see if there are any patterns in Shah's approach? Followed to examine the current crisis of 77-78?
I don't recall anybody specifically going back to the early 60s. But you have other periods in Iran which the Shah hoped to write out the story, go right back to the Mossadegh period, which he hoped to write out, and he was unable to. Then, of course, in the early 60s, he's under pressure somewhat from the United States. He appointed at first Ali Amini. Then, when Ali Amini seemed to be getting too strong, he made this an excuse to get rid of him. Then, in the mid-60s, after Ali Mansour was assassinated, Hobeda was given a considerable amount of leeway, which he grasped and ran with. So he had these sort of fits and starts. And of course, when the Rasta Keys came in with the 76, something like a 76, but don't hold me to the date, put the tether back on the political process again, because it was getting fairly open. So you have these fits and starts, as we're all aware of that pattern, whether we specifically went back and looked, at one and examined minutely, I can say, no, we probably did not. But most of us were familiar with his political style. And there's no doubt, I think, that for a very, very long time, he hoped that he could ride it out. The appointment of Sharif Ahmadi, in retrospect, was probably a bad choice, because he did not have the most savory reputation. And it was a thought, he was a tried and true supporter, a man who had been helpful in the past in many different positions, and whose father was a well-known religious figure, sort of hoped to bridge the gap there. And with Sharif Ahmadi, they knew how well the casinos went through all a whole variety of what I call minor reforms, all of which, in my view, and I can say this not with the advantage of hindsight, was sort of the wrong way to approach a political situation. I don't think you start feeding the alligators at that particular point.
Now, last meeting you talked about Mehdi Barzagran and his organization. I think you said you met him a few times. What was your assessment of Barzagran?
Well, I did not meet Barzagran personally until after after the revolution when I was chargé. And I met him, I guess, I'm sure about this two or three times. I dealt primarily with Yazdi and Amir Intizam. Those were my regular contacts. I knew some of the history, of course, of Barzagran. I was not intimate with his political history, but I had a pretty good overview of it. And I had considerable admiration for the person. This was an individual who, in my view, was democratically inclined. He did want, in my view, a fairly open political process. But a man who felt deeply tied to his own culture and religion. I think probably some of the things that happened during the 60s and 70s, not just what the Shah did in terms of political opposition, but what was happening to Iranian society deeply disturbed him. Yet, at the same time, he was a traditionalist in terms of Iran's foreign policy. He wanted good, not overly close, but he wanted solid ties with us. And he also expected to have good relations with the Soviet Union. This came to me quite specifically from him. And the actions of Yazdi and Intizam sort of bore that out. In fact, during Intizam's trial, Barzagran, I think quite courageously, stood up in front of that motley crew who tried Intizam. Defended him strongly. I said, what Intizam had done in terms of his close ties, with close relationship with us, his frequent meetings with us, etc., were at his behest. As Prime Minister, he took responsibility. He had wanted this policy. I don't know. You can meet an official many times. I did not meet him that many, but you can meet an official many times, and you don't really know him personally. But I had the impression of a kindly man, a man who, as we all know now, is, who at the time was deeply distressed at the conditions in Tehran, what the revolution had brought. It hadn't come out in a nice, clean-cut fashion that they had hoped. And he wrote again, quite courageously, he wrote to Khomeini, and these were public letters at times to Khomeini. He asked to be redeemed on a couple of occasions of his duties because of his inability to cover. So to sum up where I started out, and I think as I wrote that, find one or two messages, I felt he was inherently a decent person, a true Iranian patriot, somebody with whom we could have had a useful relationship, nothing like the relationship we had had with the Shah, of course, but that the relationship could have been based on a few basic principles and fundamentals, and that would have been quite satisfactory to us.
You mentioned Entezama a few minutes ago. Did you, were there contacts between the embassy and him before the revolution?
Yes. Yeah. And with Bazargan,
yeah,
as well. Yeah. Most of these were carried on by John Stemple, as I recall. I knew John was the principal contact.
Now, in his book, Brzezinski makes light or makes fun of a statement by William Sullivan comparing Khomeini with Gandhi. Now, but isn't it true that many of the embassy's opposition contacts saw Khomeini that way as sort of a spiritual leader and not as a political figure? But there was some sort of liberty in terms of the way the opposition saw Khomeini to make that kind of a statement.
I think in retrospect, Joseph Gandhi was unfortunate. I had to live with that little story we tell later on. But you're right. Your question would really answer your own question.
Yeah.
As I said, probably in these things before, I sort of written lectures. Khomeini is an aberration, really, within his own Shia faith. Religious leaders to give spiritual faith guidance, etc., to be critics, not to govern. And so most people expected and hoped that Khomeini would follow more the traditional role of the Marjai Tablid, would stand back and, in a sense, be the guardian, if you will, of the conscience of the people, that kind of thing. I'm not sure how many, I'm curious myself, when I become what Entezam and Bazargan and all these other people had read Khomeini's works that he pulled together when he was in Iraq. If you read his book, he spells out quite clearly that what he means is the governance by the clergy. And so that the many people in government were led by their hope as much as everybody else's. And so I think in those early days, after the brief sojourn, I forget how long it was, but fairly brief sojourn in Tehran, Khomeini did go to Qom. In fact, he was there for quite a few months, and the ministers would have to fly down and talk to him. So I think we were being guided in part by what, or impressed in part by what our Iranian colleagues hoped. And of course, as I say, we had really no historical reason to believe that Khomeini was going to become quite as intrusive as it in fact turned out. I'm talking about, we're talking now about sort of the February, March period. Well, later on, it was sometime in April, it was in May, I received a telegram from Washington asking me whether I felt that we should effort should be made to meet with Khomeini. And they threw back at me that in the only other telegram on this subject, a Sullivan said that perhaps so by Gandhi he will be in the background. Well, I did not wish to be in opposition with my ambassador, but said, and a good friend, but kind of back, I think rather delicately pointed out a few months had passed. Khomeini was clearly the principal power in the country, and I felt that we should sit down and talk to him. I said I personally did not look forward to sitting talking with him on Iranian television and being berated and castigated by the old man with little opportunity to speak myself. But I felt we should do it, and I felt that might clear the air before the new ambassador came, since we all cover was scheduled to come. So to get through that difficult, undoubtedly going to be a very difficult session, in the hopes that the ambassador could start out more or less on a clean path. I also said that I would not attempt to do so unless Bazar Khan himself approved. I was given instructions, or at least permission, to raise this with Bazar Khan. I was given authority to raise this issue with Bazar Khan, who was extremely enthusiastic. He said that he would arrange such a meeting. He saw the obvious benefits to him. He was going to try to maintain a decent relationship or an acceptable relationship with us. It was necessary for Khomeini to be sort of brought along. He told me that he would personally arrange the meeting and go with me to the session.
Okay. We'll get back to that in a little bit, but sometime in late January, before Khomeini returned to Iran, Prime Minister Bakhtiar, if the Ayatollah would not be allowed to return, I think he said this in public. Did Bakhtiar or any of the generals during this period, I guess mid to late January, consider any plans to keep Khomeini out of the country?
I think plan is much too strong a word. There's a fair amount of rhetoric as if they would keep the airport closed, and they did. You know, the several days in January, the airport was closed. There was some wild talk that the plane would be shot down. There was some wild talk that the airplane would be diverted to one of the southern islands. I'm not sure which one it was anymore. And that Khomeini would be kept there isolated from the Iranian masses, etc. But to the best of my knowledge, there was never a plan. And certainly, there was no such thing discussed with us, and we heard these stories. But it became perfectly clear that with the hundreds of thousands of people on the street and the hundreds of thousands of people who were coming to Tehran, that the government would be able to keep Khomeini out only with massive slaughter. And Bakhtiar intelligently saw that and backed down.
Now, on February 1st, Khomeini returned to Iran. Did you and Ambassador Sullivan have any kind of a strategy or approach to deal with the situation that his arrival would create?
No particular plan. Until the very day that Bakhtiar, when the government was overthrown, until the very day that the government was overthrown, I guess we picked the 10th, 11th, or 12th.
Sure, that was a weekend.
Yeah, that whole period of exactly what day you say the government disappeared. But Washington seemed to keep hoping that Bakhtiar would somehow survive. In this period, for a brief period, we did have conversations with Bazar Khan and the other people around him. Of course, Yazdi came in on a plane with Khomeini, and somebody, I forget who, had arranged a contact with Yazdi, an American, had helped us. He could very well have been for to come, so that George Lambrakis fairly early on made contact with Yazdi. We helpless position, because our policy was still not, in my view, recognizing the realities that might have changed tremendously. We were terribly concerned at the time about our own security, and Ambassador Sullivan and I were home almost certain that in one way or another, the embassy would be attacked. He and I spent a great deal of time with the security officers and the Marines and others in terms of how we would handle such a situation. At one point, we talked with a military commander who's had a base, a little walled base, at the corner of our compound, whether we might, if it could be done and under great duress, had to flee, or would he protect us? And he said, certainly. And I suppose, I'm well aware that what the handwriting was on the wall when I think it was the 12th of September, that little base was blown up, or at least the opposition, the people around, blew a hole and seized. Obviously, somebody knew of what our plan was. That was sort of the writing on the wall that our safety was certainly in peril. A few days, we kept as many of the staff, and told as many of the staff as possible, stay home, not to come into the embassy.
In Iran, were there any proposals to get in touch with him? Was there any discussion at the embassy of getting in touch with him, indirectly or directly?
Certainly not in those first few weeks, no.
Yeah.
Khomeini declared a government headed by Bazargan. I think the ambassador's written this in his book, at least it's been written someplace. And the ambassador had set up a few days before that an appointment with Bazargan to talk about the situation. But once the government, the so-called government, was set up, so probably on 8th, 9th, 10th, someplace in there, of February, the ambassador informed Bazargan that since that he could not, under those circumstances, meet with him, since we were still supporting the government of Shapur Bhatia. And Bazargan understood this. As you know, on the very time that we're being attacked on February 14th, the ambassador's driver was taking a note, formal, a diplomatic note, to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to state that we would continue relationships with Iran and, in effect, with the Bazargan government. We don't go through a formal recognition process anymore. And so the events of 10, 11, 12 were perfectly clear. The revolutionaries had won, and Washington gave us authority to. So shortly thereafter, we started having the ambassador have some contact, not very much, I don't think, with Bazargan in that period. And frankly, from February 14th to well on into March, we were basically trying to dig ourselves out from the attack on the embassy, evacuating and directing the evacuation of several thousand Americans. And so there's very little policy thinking going on. In fact, I think Ambassador Sullivan pointed out he really didn't need any guidance because the policy is very critical and caustic in this telegram that for the time being he doesn't need much guidance because he was operating with an exhausted and depleted embassy staff. That instructions in the past are not really particularly helpful.
Now, someone suggested that after Khomeini arrived and appointed Bazargan prime minister, that some embassy officials and the Iranian military negotiated with the Bazargan group to arrange an orderly transfer of power from Bakhtiar to Bazargan Khomeini. Was there any indirect embassy role in trying to facilitate the transfer of power to get Bakhtiar to acquiesce in the situation that was
It was an awkward situation in the sense that we were hoping that the military would not collapse, would not break up, and that the transition could take place. I must admit, my own mind a little unclear, precisely of the dates on this, but yes, we tried to play a major role in getting the military, the top military people, to talk with Bazargan and Ayatollah Beheshti and others. This would probably be first week of, last week of January, first week of February, in that period. I remember once we thought we had, and John Stempel played the major liaison role on this. We thought we had a meeting all set up between the two sides, or a face-to-face meeting. And then, the sort of thing that drives people wild, a great dispute about who would call on whom. So having worked frenetically in a terrible atmosphere, crowds and mobs and just getting around from one to the other part of the city was almost impossible and dangerous. So the meeting was not held at that particular time. But finally, individuals did meet. I think General Garabagi met with some of the individuals. Exactly who met during a couple of these sessions, I don't recall. But then the whole thing fell apart, you know, on February 10th and 11th. And so the effort that we had hoped to be helpful in sort of this transition sort of collapsed with it. But say about the only the one thing I would say about that effort is, to me, it has always been a kind of intelligent effort. We really had very little to work with. It was a recognition on our part that the revolutionaries were most likely to be triumphant, and that we did not, certainly at this point, want another bloodbath and have the military, which was the same. I hate to use these phrases, pro-American, I never permit them, I was in the service, to be used in America in anything that I would go over or write myself as so-and-so's pro-American. Like Kelly is, and I get along well with America, but he's pro whatever country he's from. But the military are very close to us for this reason. We did not want to see it shattered. And again, continuing in our mind, obviously, that this is a force in terms of the neighbor to the north. And as I say, so keeping the military intact as a stabilizing force, cutting back or reducing bloodshed, and recognizing the realities of what the ambassador was doing made high good sense.
Was the State Department apprised of this effort, or was it sort of like...
Yes, they were apprised of the effort, and I must admit, I keep reading about different versions of all this. I have a hard time remembering without, it was 10 years ago, about reviewing the files myself, but how much we asked permission and how much we just went ahead and did it in the absence of clear guidance and reported what we were doing. I don't quite remember who took the first step in all this.
Okay, interesting. Now, as you said earlier, the weekend or February 10th, 11th, and 12th, thereabouts, military rebellion took place and brought down the Bazargan government and bringing Bazargan and Khomeini more or less into power. How would you describe the atmosphere in the embassy and then Tehran, I guess, generally, during that period?
Well, from our viewpoint, the worst was happening. The very thing that we had hoped to avoid, as I just mentioned to you, was occurring. The military was falling apart. Their leaders were going into hiding, and some of the leaders were killed. And there was open fighting between various units of the military, and of course between various units of the military and the civilian revolutionaries. So the one looked, frankly, upon us pretty much in a terribly discouraged, almost apocalyptic fashion, the worst that we could have had happen. And we became, as I said before, greatly concerned at that stage about our own security. And we started on February 11th in burning as much stuff as we could in the embassy and telling people, as many people as possible, to stay home. because, just a little private story. My wife was evacuated very end of January. I forget it was the 29th or 30th that she left the country. And I won't go into it, the full story now. But I said to her, when they come across the wall, I hope. And then I went on with a rather bald sentence. So it wasn't if they come over the wall. And both the ambassador and I were virtually certain that that the embassy itself, you know, this huge compound, was terribly vulnerable. And that since we had been so close to the government and had been the sort of taking the brunt even then of the attack, you know, and that those a particular period, you know, we hadn't become not the devil incarnate, but it was clear that we much too central a role in Iran even is not to be attacked. And I say after the attack, we didn't really move back into the embassy until well into March. We were operating out of my residence and the ambassador's residence, you know, evacuating people.
Now, I think that embassy was occupied on February 14th, I think, is that the right? That's the right date, I think.
We were occupied for a few hours.
Yeah, yeah.
About 10:30, 10:20, something like that. Very, very heavy firing. I came into the embassy compound and into the chancery itself. All of us, most of us, fairly quickly were down on our hands and knees for the rest of the day. The people on the second floor, immediately the secretaries and people who didn't have any particular function at that time, immediately crept down the hallways to the communications center and sat there. People from the first floor who were able to also came up the stairway. That was a dangerous flight because there was a window in the stairway. Somebody across the street kept shooting into the stairwell area. But they came up and we had a very little steel door, probably an eighth of an inch thick. The bullets went through that like nothing at all. And people came and crept down the hallway. A lot of people from the administrative staff and the security officers stayed on the first floor to help direct the Marines and to carry out the orders in terms of eventually flooding the place with tear gas. Then they, just before the people, the invaders, finally turned to the embassy, to the chancery itself, they all came upstairs as well. There's a peculiar invasion, if you will, or intrusion, because after the first fusillade of shots into the embassy, which, as I think, put us all on our hands and knees, there's usually some sign of a light showing or a door moving to bring another shot, but the heavy firing into the chancery itself stopped fairly quickly, and we just decided to get the odd shot here and there. They went towards the ambassador's house and my house and the other outbuildings. There were a lot of different buildings in the compound. And once, from an intruder's point of view, that these were more or less secure, most of the Marines had surrendered under the ambassador's instructions one by one. They would get hold of the ambassador who was sitting in my office, his office, become too unsafe. Had big French doors, whereas mine had just the regular windows. So he sort of sat on the floor there, and he kept ordering his Marines and say, "Sir, I'm under heavy fire." And the Marines were not supposed to have death-dealing ammunition. Some of them may have disobeyed orders, I don't know. There were certain rules that they did. But the ambassador said, "All right, if it's possible, say, we surrender." And one by one, pretty much, they surrendered. And some of the intruders finally get into the chancery, fought their way through the tear gas up to the second floor, and started pounding on the door, at which point one of our local employees, who just pulled, and I just happened to be in the embassy, had come over with the consul general that morning, and I went down and interpreted and said that we would surrender if the guy just didn't try to sort of blow down the door. And so we all went to the ambassadorial suite with our hands up. We held there. It's hard to remember how long it was, but almost at the very time that we were being held, a counterforce directed from afar at the beginning by a foreign from Bayazd came into the compound. There was more shooting. Not a great deal. There was no pitched battle, but there was a fair amount of shooting. And the people who had intruded agreed to leave the compound.
Did you find who the groups were that were occupying the embassy?
You know, I never did find out precisely. The assumption was that it was a mixed, this was not just a one group. But certainly some of the people who came into the embassy grounds were the Mujahideen, they called the people. Some of them were the Fedayeen, the Charikai Fedayeen, they called people. Several of them had had training in the Middle East. They came in with their kafirs on their head, and looking particularly ferocious. So it was a mixed bag. And I think once people got over the wall, a whole horde of people just followed. It was pretty well planned. They knew where everything was in the compound. Were pretty smart. They had obviously been listening to some of our communications at some place along the line. They had got hold of a radio, kind of walkie-talkies. As the Marines used to joke at times, because we assumed that they were listening to us, the Marines used to joke, be careful to claim more mines now. You don't want to be talking to them. They said, well, I'm going to come by your post. They said, well, be very careful to claim more mines. You know, the field that's set up in the trees there. The other Marines saying, no, I understand, I'll be very careful. So when these guys came over the wall, they were extremely careful and cautious as they advanced towards the ambassador's residence, because they were looking around for all the claymore mines that were supposed to be up in the trees.
It sounds like House members suggested that the people who walked by the embassy wanted to serve notice to the U.S. there would be no coup allowed, or no counter-coup, or no counter-revolution, or something to that effect.
You'd have to talk to the people who went over the fence.
Yeah.
The days before they came over, the rumor, of course, was sweeping Tehran that a very substantial number of Sadak people had taken refuge, that military officers and other people whom they really wanted to get their hands on had taken refuge in the embassy. But I think the basic reason is what you said, is that having gone through the Mossadegh period, they wanted to make sure that the American embassy was in no position, which we certainly were, but they didn't know that, in no position to bring about a kind of revolution. I think it also was a locus for the beginning of the struggle within the revolutionary groups. A couple of them were trying to sort of get one up on Mazarin, and if you want to call them the moderates, and one up really on Khomeini. And so that we were the locus at that time of the internal struggle as well as the points that I just made.
How would you describe the administration's stance, the Carter administration's stance, towards the new regime that was?
I came home in March of 1979 for a couple weeks rest to be reunited with my wife. And the main thing was rest. And I received instruction. The understanding was that I would come home for a couple of weeks rest, recuperation, and go back as chargé so the bill could come out very informally. He's taking leave too, but full understanding when he left, I would take over, and then a new ambassador would in due course be named. So I met with Warren Christopher, and I had a long session with Dave Newsom and with Harold Saunders. So I can't even, Newsom and Saunders are both personal friends and career people. And therefore I assume that they were speaking for the administration. But I was told to go back to Iran and to emphasize that the American government felt that there was a sufficient basis of mutual interest so that a relationship much different than the previous one, but a mutually beneficial, useful relationship could be established. I was told to emphasize our common interests in the territorial integrity of Iran, in the common interest of political stability, economic development of Iran, and that historically the reasons for our importance to Iran were clear, that this was sufficient basis, we thought, for the future. We could build a respectable relationship.
We're kind of modus vivendi, basically. We're kind of modus vivendi.
Yes.
Was there any discussion of a public statement by Vance or Carter to that effect that the U.S. accepted the new regime?
Certainly when I was chargé, I requested a clearer statement than we seemed to be getting. My own suggestion was lower key to say Vance or Carter, but was it Hal Saunders, who is highly respected throughout the Middle East, go on VOA and make a small speech, a question and answer kind of, which he would bring out strongly the very points that, one, we accepted the fact that the Iranian people had revolted and we wanted a respectful relationship with the new government and the people of Iran. Our ties were with the people of Iran as well. I don't know whatever happened to that suggestion, because it was never made, and the speech was never made. There were, I think if you go with the time to research the State Department spokesman statements and probably White House spokesman, so I'm sure at some point they say, yeah, we accept the revolution. The fact is, of course, the success of the revolution was a hell of a shock to the administration.